Great. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to speak today. And you know, what I'm going to talk about is not quite in line with the main thrust of this program, which, as I understand it, is an attempt to use string theory to really understand beyond the standard model physics. String theory is a grand unifying theory, way of understanding quantum mechanics and gravity on the same footing. But it is, in some very real sense, string phenomenology. String theory is an attempt to maybe not make experimental predictions, but at least to make contact with experiment or to brush with experiment. I like to think of it as some kind of, I guess this doesn't quite work. Is there another one? I have to be gentle. It was working before. These are old-fashioned technology. I think of it very much as applied string theory. So not as a way of, say, predicting ratios of lepton masses or neutrino masses or something, or explaining the hierarchy problem, but as using string theory as a calculational tool, a way of using string theory to understand some physical problem that we otherwise don't have very many tools in our toolbox. And also a problem that is very real for experimentalists. So there's sort of two things in my motivation here. The first is really to try and make this brush with experiment, to try and understand in particular heavy quark physics at the relativistic heavy ion collider at Brookhaven. And the plan here is essentially to have some string theory model, some string theory calculational tools that will produce the diffusion constant. And at the end of the day, I mean, there's a lot of hand-waving that goes on, but that tries to get from that diffusion constant some observables at RIC. And this is in fact a rather hard argument to make, and you know, I'll let you guys be the judge of how successful it is. I think at least some of you will come away convinced it's pretty interesting. But if this doesn't work, I hope to at least leave you with the second idea that, and maybe we're not really understanding QCD, but we do, I think, have a very real way of understanding related, strongly interacting non-abelian plasmas, this famous N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. So the techniques I'm going to show you today really provide a theoretical laboratory, I would say, for studying these kinds of plasmas. So my work in this is contained in these two papers I'm going to tell you about today. So this is the paper with Andreas Karch, Larry Yaffe at Seattle. Sean Kochaz is a graduate student up in Seattle, and Pavel Kovtun, who used to be in Seattle but is now here as a postdoc. And the second is this paper, which I claim sole responsibility. It's a little bit more speculative. So the outline of my talk is essentially an answer to three different questions. I mean, I've been giving this talk quite a bit, and there's some people in the audience who I guess have heard it at least twice at this point. So I've made an effort to change it around a little bit and add some new stuff. And so, in fact, the questions are not quite the same as they used to be, as you may or may not may or may not realize. Well, in fact, I did not, but David Mateos did last week, and so I've removed part of my talk because you all heard David's talk, and you all remember what he said about pressure and viscosity at Yang-Mills, and if not, I'll say a few words to remind you. But the questions I want to answer today, I want to spend a lot of time at the beginning talking about what there really is to understand about heavy quarks at the heavy ion collider. And in fact, I should add, in some sense, I'm doing LHC physics too, because as I understand it, there's a detector called ALICE at the LHC, which will be used to measure heavy ion collisions. And in fact, I think CMS can also do this, and maybe even ATLAS. And if you know, people in the audience don't object too strenuously, they're going to spend, you know, a month or so, a year, not looking for beyond the standard model physics, but colliding heavy ions at the LHC, and so they're going to have higher energy results for these heavy ion collisions. And you know, if one of you thinks of some way of using the techniques I'm going to tell you about today to predict what's going to happen at LHC, you could say you're using string theory to make a prediction about LHC physics, which I think is pretty neat, although probably not what most of you had in mind. The second question is, what can string theory say about RIC physics? And this is this story about heavy quark diffusion. and trying to make contact with some Rick observables and heavy quark diffusion from a string theory computation. This is a tough argument to make, and you'll see why it's so tough. And the last thing I want to talk about, so this is in response to my advertisement I made last week at the end of David Mateos's talk. Someone asked about what other things are universal in these strongly interacting non-abelian plasmas. So I want to try and make an argument for some more universal type quantities that come out of these kinds of computations. In particular, I want to talk about a speculative bound on a friction coefficient. So any questions before I go on to the onto Rick physics? I think so, but I have no idea what the details are of this LHC experiment. I can tell you it will be about 25 times higher in energy. So if you think about the temperature scaling as a T to the fourth power of the temperature is scaling with the energy, that will about double the temperature. What it is at Rick. But I can't tell you anything about the details of the LHC. But I want to, despite the fact that I'm not an expert, I want to tell you something. So begin with Rick. So this is the circular accelerator. It's in Long Island. I probably should have a picture, but I don't. It collides gold and other heavy nuclei, such as lead, and also light nuclei, like protons and deuterons. It collides gold at about 200 GeV per nucleon. That's the energy. And there are four detectors. They're called Star, Phoenix, Phobos, and Brahms. Phobos and Brahms are small. And I mentioned Star and Phoenix because they're Star and Phoenix are the two main detectors. And I'm mentioning Phoenix here because I'm going to show you a slide with data later on that comes from Phoenix. Okay? And the last thing here is the most speculative statement on this, or not speculative, but a controversial statement on this transparency. These gold nuclei, when they collide, they're believed to produce a quark gluon plasma at thermal equilibrium. So there's the first troubling statement that it's thermal equilibrium. There are theorists who are still kind of scratching their heads about that and wondering if they can mock up something that looks like thermal equilibrium that really isn't at thermal equilibrium. But if it is at thermal equilibrium, it would have a temperature of maybe roughly 250 MeV. I'm not quite sure what the error bars on that. They're probably pretty large, maybe order 50 or so MeV. And then it's also believed to be pretty strongly coupled with an alpha strong of about a half. So I've been going back and forth about what number to put there. The number in our paper is a half. I gave a talk a few times where it was a quarter. Then it really depends what process you're talking about. Even at finite temperature, depending on what process, alpha strong will scale. I'm talking about really long distance kinds of processes, some quark traveling through the plasma. So the people who know more, who I've talked to, people like Larry Yaffe and Bernd Mueller, assure me it's one half is a good number. But I don't know. It's debatable. Any questions about this? Okay, so heavy quarks at Rick. So you don't really produce these heavy quarks at thermal equilibrium. You produce them in the initial stages of the collision, where you have lots of high-energy stuff. They're heavy. I'm talking about charm and bottom quarks, so they're heavy with respect to the temperature. So like a charm quark would weigh in at about 6 times 250 MeV, and a bottom quark at about 20 times 250 MeV. So you don't really produce them at thermal equilibrium. But you do produce them at the very early stages of the collision. Before you get to thermal equilibrium, you have these small quantities of these quarks, these very massive quarks traveling around, and you can think of them as probes of the plasma. You try and use them to understand what's going on in this plasma. These quarks are detectable, so they'll hadronize into D and B mesons, into charmonium, J psi, and then these heavy mesons have characteristic decay channels, for example, single lepton decay, so you can you do a lot of work and you try and figure out which single leptons are coming from these heavy mesons, and this is what the experimentalists make their money doing. But you can detect them. That's the message I want to leave with you here. No questions so far. So the observables at RIC that I have in mind today, to try and connect to this diffusion constant for heavy quarks, I have two kinds of observables in mind. One is elliptic flow, the other is jet quenching. I don't know how familiar the audience is with these. I'm assuming not too. So elliptic flow is this azimuthal anisotropy of the produced hadrons with respect to the reaction plane. So in English, what does that mean? You have these two nuclei, they come together, they form this big cloud of stuff that expands, and it doesn't necessarily expand isotropically. So this elliptic flow measures the anisotropy of this expanding cloud. Okay, I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute. And jet quenching, this is a reabsorption of a hard parton as it travels through the fireball. So you get fewer jets in some sense at Rick with gold-gold collisions than you would with, say, proton-proton collisions. So let me say a little bit more about that. So here's my cartoon of the fireball. It's this red circle. So you imagine, you know, in this event, you form a couple of hard partons, some quark-anti-quark pair that's, you know, traveling apart from each other by momentum conservation. So maybe it's formed close to the surface. So this quark that's very close to the surface, he makes it out of the soup without any problem. He doesn't necessarily interact too much with the surrounding stuff. This other guy has a long distance to go. I think it's order of, say, 12 Fermi or so. These clouds are about 12 Fermi long wide in these gold-gold collisions. And he has a very high probability of interacting with the soup and downscattering, so his momentum decreases. He may not, you know, emerge from the other side in any recognizable fashion or at all. So this leads to suppression of back-to-back jets in these collisions. So that's something you can measure. You see one jet, but you don't see another jet traveling the other direction. This guy, yeah, I mean, he eventually hadronizes, sure. But he doesn't, in that process, he interacts far less than his partner. So you see, you almost certainly won't see him at as high a transverse momentum, and you may not see him at all. There's another observable which is more important for this talk, because the data uses this observable. It's this RAA suppression factor. It's a function, again, of transverse momentum. So what you do is you collide gold-gold, and then you also collide proton-proton. So the proton-proton fireball is much smaller. There are many fewer nucleons. And you expect the mesons in these proton-proton collisions to downscatter far, far less. And so what you see is you see a suppression. And if you plot this ratio as a function of transverse momentum, you see a suppression of the mesons in gold relative to proton-proton, if you normalize appropriately for the fact that you have far, far more nucleons in these gold-gold collisions. This fireball, I think, is typically about 12 Fermi. That's rough scale. And it depends, I guess, also on what nuclei you're colliding. But for gold-gold, I think it's about 12. So I promised to say a little bit more about elliptic flow. So here's my cartoon of what happens in this collision. We have these two circles. They're supposed to represent the two nuclei, one traveling, say, into the screen and one traveling out of the screen. They're relativistic. They're very highly boosted, so they look like pancakes. So if they collide with some impact parameter, the pieces out here just shear off. And maybe you can collect them and get a sense of what this impact parameter was for this collision. And you're left with this elliptical-shaped region, okay, which then subsequently expands. And what you want to do is you want to bin everything that's produced as a function of transverse momentum and this azimuthal angle. Okay, and you measure the anisotropy of that stuff. You essentially measure the first Fourier coefficient in terms of this azimuthal angle. And that's the elliptic flow. Appropriately normalized. Okay, that's the definition. Now I wanted to say two things about this elliptic flow, one of which is not on the transparency and one of which is. The first thing is that this a large elliptic flow is often used to argue that this quark-gluon plasma comes to very rapid thermal equilibrium. So how does that argument work? So if you come to very rapid thermal equilibrium, then you can set up a pressure gradient in this elliptical region, which is typically much larger in the narrow direction than in the larger vertical direction. Okay, so when this thing expands, it will expand much more in the narrow direction than in the vertical direction, and you'll get a relatively large elliptic flow. Now, if it doesn't thermalize, then you don't set up this pressure gradient, and the expansion is much more isotropic. So the fact that they see such a large elliptic flow, they used to then turn around and say, well, you know, it must have come to very rapid thermal equilibrium. And how did it come to some rapid thermal equilibrium? Well, it must have been very strongly interacting. I mean, this was a great surprise when they saw this large elliptic flow, I guess, these experimentalists and the theorists who were thinking about this, because they knew, for example, from this plot that David showed last week of the pressure, that the strongly coupled pressure was roughly 80% of the weakly coupled pressure. So, the pressure close to the deconfinement temperature was roughly 80% of the perturbative result. So probably you can use perturbation theory to understand these kinds of collisions. But then if you use perturbation theory, you expect a much longer equilibration process. And in fact, in order to explain these very large elliptic flows, you need these things to thermalize on a timescale of 1 Fermi over C. Okay.
Can you explain why thermalization leads to this large pressure gradient?
Can I explain that in real time? I don't think I can explain that in real time, but I can turn it around and say that if you weren't at thermal equilibrium, then there'd be no correlation of the velocities in here. And so when it expanded, it would have to expand isotropically. So the degree to which you can set up some thermal equilibrium in here, you can break the... You can make the distribution of velocities, in some sense, reflect the distribution of particles. Maybe some hydrodynamic modeling of this. So that's the first thing I wanted to say, which was not on this transparency. And the second thing I wanted to say about this is that people often use this large elliptic flow to make yet one more argument to support the claim that this quark-gluon plasma has a very small viscosity. Because morally, I don't really have to do much to convince you of that, but I mean, if it had a large viscosity, then as this thing expanded, it would tend to make the expansion much more isotropic, right? It'd be much more viscous, and you wouldn't see this large elliptic flow.
This isn't about it being a surprise that it's strongly coupled. How far do you get if you just try and make a naive estimate based on the scale and the problem, the complexity that you're getting from this fireball?
If you make an estimate, well, I mean, I think this notion of this pressure calculation from the lattice was one attempt to try and make such a back of the envelope argument that.
Well, what I'm trying to say is, I guess, if perturbation theory were self-consistent, but you could just do it analytically. That's my definition. And so you would see that some of that was self-consistent, that the scales are working or not. Just kind of like, I'm just a little confused about why the experiments
are needed to determine, aside from the basic energy scale, density, twice an experiment. The perturbation theory would have predicted small elliptic flows that are coming. And since they measured a large one, that gives evidence that perturbation theory is wrong, not that it was correct.
Right, but what I'm trying to ask is, would you have thought perturbation theory should be correct given the energy scale we're working at?
What is perturbation theory talking about? People are trying to make hadronic collisions, right? Multi-hadron, multi-particle collisions to try to model this. Do they also get very small elliptic flow in that case?
No, this elliptic flow is due to interactions in the deconfined phase. It has nothing to do with this.
That's an assumption, though. I'm asking if you assume that it doesn't have a deconfined phase. It's just proton-proton nuclei collisions. What do you get out of it? These multi-particle collisions.
Well, but if you have proton-proton...
You've done that, right?
I'm sure.
If you have proton-proton, you don't have this anisotropy, so you don't have any elliptic flow there, right? I mean, everything is isotropic.
The anisotropy just comes from the collision. Just from the finite impact parameter.
There are other things, like, for example, the suppression in production of germanium. It has to do with the fact that you create
I'm sure there are other things, but I'm just questioning this one. You know, whether this is by itself saying, could you model this? People did model this with just proton-neutron collisions, multi-particle collisions,
what did they get, large or small, with their throwing nucleus, or you just didn't believe the calculations?
I don't know the answer to that question. It's an interesting question. But what I'd like to say is that these collisions are extremely complicated, and people have tried all sorts of different things to model what happens, and it's sort of very hard to know exactly where things are going wrong, I think, a lot of the time. You have this expanding fireball, the temperature, you're not really at thermal equilibrium, you have things that are moving and cooling down. And
it's true that if you put it in my weakish coupling at that temperature, it wouldn't thermalize it.
Yeah.
And I think that's true, because even though we probably people try to incorporate these nonlinear effects to explain why it might thermalize faster than why it might be more antibody.
Yeah, my understanding is that if you assume a weak coupling, then you need a fairly long equilibration time, which is much longer than this one Fermi over C. But for which process?
I don't think there's any reason to believe that just above the decompiling state condition, you should be at weak coupling.
Right.
And in fact, when I started looking at this, my surprise was why the community believed so broadly that you were at weak coupling. And the reason for that is that the lattice calculation figure itself, that is off from a weak being, from a fertility calculation by 20%.
So is the point that
they realized that you were at the wrong scale for overturning calculation, but thought that they could reliably, that it was a good guide, perturbation theory would be a good guide?
Perturbation theory winds up being, they thought perturbation theory would be a good guide to some temperature relatively close to TC. Certainly not at TC, but here you're 250, maybe TC is 170, 180. They thought, you know, that 50 MeV is enough to push you at weak coupling. So I've been talking about elliptic.
So at LHC, would you then be at weak coupling regime if you boost the energy by a factor of?
By 25, you boost the temperature by a factor of 2, and lattice results suggest that the coupling changes a little bit. Not a whole lot. I mean, depending what you mean exactly mean by coupling, which process you want to think about, like string tensions, something like that.
Yeah, but then it will cool off. It will go to a state that's 250. Everything will be obscured by that.
It's long running, so it's actually
so let me go on. So I've been talking about this elliptic flow and these RA suppression factors in terms of the whole explosion, but you can just focus on the heavy quark sector. You can pretend, for example, for the elliptic flow, that you have some liquid of heavy quark mesons and try and measure the elliptic flow with respect to those heavy hadrons. You could also imagine looking at jets just formed from Charmer bottom quarks. And I mean, the thing I just want to say here is that these observables are going to be sensitive to the rate at which these heavy quarks lose energy to the quark gluon plasma. And now I can show you some data of the elliptic flow and this RA suppression factor for these heavy flavor component of the explosion. So this is a paper that came from the Phoenix group. It appeared last month. I've been waiting for this paper for a long time, and this is the first time I get to show this plot. So on the vertical axis here, we have the RA suppression factor in this elliptic flow as a function of transverse momentum. And these blue dots are the data. And you see the RA suppression factor is close to 1 for small PT events, as it should be, and then it falls off, indicating that you get some kind of jet suppression. And this elliptic flow, it has this sort of characteristic rise as a function of PT, and then falls off for the heavier guys because they don't the higher energy guys because they don't thermalize as well. So also on these plots are a number of theoretical models. I'm most interested in this Morantini model because it's closest in spirit to what I'm going to show you from the string theory point of view. I just point out there's also this Armesto model, which models the energy loss of a quark using I guess bremsstrahlung or gluon gluon emission, that's this green line. There's a Van Hees model, which is kind of a phenomenological model using, assuming that these quarks have, the interaction between these quarks is boosted by some kind of resonance effect. And finally, there's this Morantini model. So these numbers, these are diffusion constants for the heavy quark. Basically, they use these as input parameters and generate these red curves for different diffusion constants for these heavy quarks. And you see the red curves. The last few times I gave this plot, they had different curves that I could compare, and the curves fit the data much better, and now they seem to fit the data pretty badly. But and they have all kinds of detail in them, which the data doesn't have because the error bars are too large. But roughly speaking, maybe I can claim, or this is what the Phoenix paper would seem to suggest, that the you know some range of diffusion constants between, say, 3 and 12 over 2 pi t is, you know, gives you sort of a rule of thumb for what heavy quarks are doing in this at RIC.
At tiny pt, why does the velocity go to zero? Because the things really only escape after things have time to turn into a sphere.
At tiny pt. How does this work?
By the time those things are measured.
Well, yeah, you're just binning the stuff that's produced at the end of the day. I think it's just that. Can I answer this? I'm not sure I can answer this question. It's a good question. I can't tell you. I can tell you why it goes down at large PT.
99% of the particles sit below 3 PT. I've been below 3. This is 3 G. So whatever this high PT is, it's already non-hydrodynamic at this position.
Out here is non-hydrodynamic.
Yeah.
But he's asking here.
Oh, it's you.
Yeah, but you also have blind spots in your detector. Just because you have two
type of the it's a real physical effect. You do hydrodynamic modeling and it goes to zero down here. And I don't have a simple reason for it. So everyone willing to buy, at least temporarily, that we could run with, say, a diffusion constant of, say, 3 to 12 over 2 pi t? I mean, it's true, right, that these plots on the neither of these, the value for the diffusion constant that you need to fit this data seems incompatible with the one that you need to fit this data, right? This sort of this smaller value is better for elliptic flow, and this larger value is better for RAA.
So far, none of this has been ADS-DFT, is that
correct? I haven't done any string theory yet. I mean, this paper actually cited us, and so it's very gratifying. I've never been satisfied cited by an experimentalist before. This is some hydrodynamic model assuming a diffusion constant for the quark, and you have all sorts of effects that they model in there too, like hadronization and decay rates at bottom quarks. And these other people have similar models, which they have different inputs. This is some kind of gluon emission model, and this is some resonant interaction model.
So is the fact that the data doesn't fit any of these groups pretty well evidence that the diffusion constant is not actually constant, or is it evidence that there are more of these complicated effects that need to be modeled to understand the detailed shape of the
curve? It could be either way. I mean, this is, we should probably wait for the star detector to produce a similar paper, see if the story changes, see if Morantini have more bells and whistles they want to add to their models, or not bells and whistles, but real physical effects they need to incorporate. And yeah, I mean, maybe it's just that you can't model this with a single diffusion constant. That's also possible.
Isn't it also true that the temperature is changing in the system?
Absolutely, yeah. The temperature, when I say 250 MeV, I mean that's the maximum temperature reached, and then it will quickly cool over a timescale of 12 Fermi over C.
Is there a correlation between, say, the high PT stuff coming out at high temperature and the low PT stuff coming out at smaller temperatures came out when the thing expanded?
Yeah, so it would have to do with the scalopes as well.
So then maybe you should see some effect of temperature dependence in this. Use one diffusion constant, but the temperature is changing.
That would be something to try. So I have this diffusion constant. So again, I'm going to go back to this Morantini paper where I steal their perturbative result, or not borrow, at least borrow their perturbative result for the diffusion constant. So they calculated perturbatively in QCD what this diffusion constant is for heavy quarks. It has this very complicated factor which depends on things like the Debye mass and the Euler-Mascheroni constant, which is essentially 1. And then this leading factor, which I'd like you to focus on, so you have dA, that's the mass of the adjoint representation of your group, essentially n squared for large n, large number of colors, and the coupling, g to the fourth, and the temperature. So sitting down here, right, you have a square of the Tuft coupling. Okay, so the diffusion constant scales as 1 over the square of the Tuft coupling. So parametrically, that's a large number in the regime where you can trust this result, which is its small coupling. And moreover, in this, they assumed that the Debye mass was small compared to the temperature. Another important assumption for this perturbative result. But at RIC, neither of these things is necessarily true. The coupling is order 1, and the Debye mass is order the temperature. Okay, so never mind. Let's just go ahead and plug in the numbers and see if we can use this result to estimate what the diffusion constant should be at RIC. And Morantini did that, and they estimated about 6 over 2 pi t, which is suspiciously in the range provided here. And I suspect that may be due in part to the fact that Morantini were, or at least Tini was collaborating closely in the production of this paper, I think. But so perturbative results, if you just, you know, push them into a regime where you really can't trust them, they seem to do okay. Okay? You know, when I used to give this talk, I had different plots, and then I could argue that this number was much larger than the number suggested by data, but I can't do that anymore, so now I have to make a different argument. Say.
They're just from getting more data, it fit better?
Or? The data got better, and Morantini changed their plots to incorporate more physical effects like quark fragmentation and bottom decay. And
I see. So the lesson is that those effects can be important to just the naive diffusion process.
Yeah. So.
Why do you need to make any argument? You want to argue the strength of the problem? Or?
I want to argue that I can add something new to this discussion, that I can try and get this number from a completely orthogonal angle, and it's going to be close to what data is suggesting. So why should string theory be useful? Here's sort of where I've amputated some of my talk, but I mean, I just say very naively, you know, string theory suggests searching for some kind of duality. You have some strongly coupled model, some weakly coupled model. You can do calculations in the weakly coupled model, predict strongly coupled physics. And so the example I want to start with is this ADS-CFT example, right? N equals 4 SUN Cibriang-Mills is dual to this type 2B string theory in ADS-5 cross S5. Most of the audience knows this very well. And then we dress this up a little bit to bring it closer to the physics we want to understand. So we add a black hole to ADS-5. That raises the temperature. So the Hawking temperature of the black hole is the temperature of the field theory. I have some radial coordinate u, so the horizon radius will scale with the temperature. And I want to add a heavy flavor. So I add a D7 brain in the way suggested by Karch and Katz a few years ago that wraps this five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space down to some minimal radius um, which is, and this is dual to adding some kind of massive n equals 2 hypermultiplet to the n equals 4 theory. So just in pictures, what I said before in words, here's my picture of ADS space. I have a D7 brain which wraps ADS down to some minimal radius u sub m. I have a horizon. And I have strings. So I want to model these quarks and mesons as classical strings in this geometry. So here's a single quark configuration that stretches from the D7 brain to the horizon. And here's a meson, some loop of string with both ends on the D7 brain. So in order to keep this analysis classical, I have to keep the length of these strings large. compared to the temperature scale. So how does that work? Well, the mass of the quark is, to a first approximation, the length of the string, so it really scales as um minus uh. So to keep things large, I need um minus uh to be large compared to the temperature scale. And in fact, there's a factor of the TUF coupling in this argument which really helps me. So by tuning up the TUF coupling, I can move the D7 brain closer and closer to the horizon, still keeping things classical. So that's my picture. And now I want to try to extract some kind of behavior of these quarks in the system. And our paper basically organizes itself into two thought experiments. So you think about the end of this string as the quark traveling through some kind of viscous medium. So the rate of change of its momentum is proportional to some drag coefficient times p times momentum itself plus some external force. So we have the opportunity of applying some external force. So I have two experiments in mind. One, you turn the force on at time t equals zero and then turn it off and watch how the quark slows down and extract this friction coefficient mu. Okay, and the second experiment is dragging the quark at some constant velocity so the dp dt term drops out. And if you assume a dispersion relation, so you assume, say, p non-relativistically is mass times the velocity, you can extract from the second experiment a product of the mass times the friction coefficient, which is the force you apply divided by the speed. So those are the two thought experiments. So this is going to be important for my universality, and this is going to be important for the diffusion constant. So I don't really want to present any technical details, and the time is already growing late. So let me just say enough so that, in principle, you could reproduce all that we did. I'm going to have some line element for this black hole background. Okay, so my black hole in this ADS space. So that's this radial term. And it has my gauge theory directions, t and x. There's some warping factor, h, which goes to zero at the horizon. So this is the space in which the curved space in which these strings move. And that the equations of motion governing this classical string are just governed by the Nambu-Goto action string. So I have some tension, some induced metric on the world sheet. So from this, you can reproduce all that we did with a paper and pencil and a computer. It took us probably longer than it should have, but dragging the string. So here I want to try and get to a diffusion constant. There exists a very nice analytic solution, which was also independently discovered by Steve Gubser, corresponding to a single quark moving at some constant velocity in response to an electric field. So you can apply an electric field to the quark by changing the boundary condition on the string on the D7 brain in the standard way. Okay, so you have this configuration for the string, which I'm not going to write down, basically comes down to the horizon and then extends to the left forever, and it moves to the right at some constant velocity. But I will write down the momentum current you need to keep this string moving that's supplied by this electric field, and it takes this simple form, where it depends on the square root of the TUF coupling, the temperature squared, and this curious-looking relativistic factor. So that curious-looking relativistic factor cries out to be identified as some kind of momentum, right? So we just multiply by m and divide by m, and we extract a friction coefficient. Or really, we extract a friction coefficient times the mass, having assumed some dispersion relation for the quark. Okay? So that's a nice result for the friction coefficient, analytic result for the friction coefficient of this heavy quark and this n equals 4 super Young Mills plasma. Okay? So from this, you can get a few more things. You could, for example, assume this quark obeys some kind of Langevin type equation from which you can extract a jet quenching parameter. Jet quenching parameters, if you have a quark traveling in some direction, it's the rate at which momentum diffuses off the direction of travel. So there was a group from MIT who at about the same time had a completely orthogonal derivation of this jet quenching parameter, which is parametrically the same as ours, but differs from ours from about 15% numerically in this prefactor, this 2 pi. Oh, incidentally, that if you plug in the numbers, I think you get something that's about a factor of 2 or so, factor of 7 or so smaller than the number that was used in this data. So I claim this Armesto guy, this paper by Armesto, they used a jet quenching parameter type analysis, and they had to assume a jet quenching parameter of about 14, I think, to get this line. We plug in our numbers, we only get about 2 in this formula, I think, or maybe 3 or 4, depending on what kind of games you play.
Some disagreement among groups who are both using AES-EFT?
Yeah, this MIT group has this completely orthogonal result for the jet quenching parameter, which has a different number. We may not be calculating the same thing. It may be that what we're doing is really not valid relativistically, and what they're doing is only valid relativistically. Maybe one resolution. They've promised a longer paper, and I'm looking forward to it because I don't really understand their original paper, their arguments in their original paper.
And they have the same setup, or do they change how they add the massive flavor? Because that could also change things.
They don't have the ability to tune the mass of the flavor. They just think of the D7 brain as sitting at the boundary of ADS. And they study Wilson loops. So again, they're not really thinking of Wilson loops in the fundamental, but in the adjoint representation, which is another subtle difference. You can also, from this analysis, extract a diffusion constant, okay, using essentially an Einstein relation. So I get this 2 over pi square root lambda t, and it's that I'm going to compare with data in a moment. So this result was also independently derived at about the same time by Castleberry, Solana, and Tini back in May. Okay, but notice that there's a square root lambda downstairs.
Before you can compare the data, if you did your same calculation, but again with some other way of introducing flavors, there must be, you know, a dozen ways of introducing flavors. Do you get the same? You presumably don't get the same results, but do they differ in some small enough way that the comparable data is meaningful?
Sorry, what do you want to do with the flavors?
Just get them a different way. Study an N=2 theory that has an AES tool that has massive flavors built into it instead of having trophic N=4. You can do the same calculation if you're clever enough. Do you actually think different ADS-CFT models would give the same result, or how much is your theoretical uncertainty just by your choice of how to add the flavor limits?
These results do seem to depend sensitively on the particular model you take. I don't know exactly about changing the way you add flavor, but if you change the background, I mean, if you were to, for example, use backgrounds at finite chemical potential, or you'd use beta deformed backgrounds that Naldesane and Lunin used, or you to use them anyway.
Yeah, just a different ADS-CFT that happens to have massive flavor.
A lot of these numbers will change. You'll get these numbers are in that sense not universal.
But the comparison with data is still meaningful because they don't change by enough to make it non-meaningful.
Is the relationship between those two universal? I mean, eventually you're going to tell us that Q doesn't fit the data very well, but the D fits reasonably well. And I'm just curious what that lesson tells us about hydrodynamic models in general.
So at weak coupling, the processes important for diffusion are collision of the heavy quark with gluons and light quarks in the medium, and also gluon emission. So I think gluon emission is often associated with just this jet quenching parameter, whereas the collisions, these elastic collisions, are associated with sort of lower energy processes and a diffusion constant. At strong coupling, it's really not clear if you can think about energy loss in those simple collisional terms because you don't have a very clear picture when the mean free path gets very small. I don't know. Does that help answer your question? So I want to play some games to compare with data. So there's a perturbative result for N=4 Yang-Mills by Chesler and Vorarinen, which appeared this summer. It looks very similar to the QCD result, has this complicated factor, and a very similar prefactor, which also scales as 1 over the square of the TOEFF coupling. dA, remember, was nc squared minus 1. Okay, so here the two results are plotted, R is in the perturbative result, 1 over the diffusion constant. So here's the perturbative result, and here's our result. You know, some perturbative results, some quadratic dependence, weak quadratic dependence on the TOEFF coupling, and some square root dependence on the TOEFF coupling. So the game I want to play is the following. I want to pretend, for no particularly good reason, that the ratio of the strong coupling QCD result to the weak coupling QCD result is the same as for super Yang mills. Sort of in similar spirit to these viscosity to entropy ratios or these pressure ratio that David talked about last week. Oh, and I want to assume alpha is strong as 0.5, and then if I plug in the relevant factors as pi and 4, I get lambda of about 20. Other people have been playing different games. Steve Gupser recently wrote a paper where there's a fairly elaborate game along these lines is played. So the weak coupling ratio, it turns out to be 4 if I use 3 light flavors. Our result for lambda of 20 is about 1 over 7 times t. Not really including very many significant digits here. I have no reason to. So from which we conclude, I multiply by 4, I get 4 over 7 t based on this ad hoc argument involving the ratios. And the data earlier was suggesting something in a range, maybe 3 to 13 over 7 times t. So you get the right answer or something that's in the right range. I mean, it remains to be seen whether this will hold up and whether people can play better games that are better motivated. But I think that's very interesting that using this completely different model, the super Yang mills, you get something that's in, I would say, semi-quantitative agreement with data. So some of you are certainly not convinced by that, and some of you, I hope, are at least interested.
In fact, it's not worse than the perturbative computation.
It's what?
It's of the same level.
It's the same level as the perturbative result, which was, if you remember, Morantini was 6 over 7 times.
Are you using 3 flavors or 4 flavors in that
one? I think I used 3 flavors and 3 colors here. I don't know exactly.
Well, that would give exactly 4. The question is, when you put all the approximations everywhere, were you balancing both possibilities?
I mean,
if we make enough people 4, that brings that ratio down a little bit. So.
Right. 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 Then you can make it closer to 3. There are other games you can certainly play.
I probably missed this. What's the logic that says the ratio of these is constant as you extrapolate in GN? Is there some suggestion that it is, or that it changes to 1/10?
There is, in fact, no particularly good argument that this would be true. I think it, in fact, is dependent on G, on the coupling.
On GN.
Yeah. So my last 10 minutes, I want to tell you about universality as promised. So, I mean, even if you don't buy this argument that we can say something about data, at least we have a model in which we're calculating analytically all these nice quantities about some strongly interacting non-abelian plasma. So far we've been talking about n equals 4 super Yang mills. And so I want to tell you about a few more results along that line, and then take a step back and look at some more general models along these lines. So I want to take a straight string, a single quark solution that stretches from the D7 range to the horizon and consider linearized fluctuations. So this is essentially a non-relativistic quark. And there are a number of very nice results you can extract from this linearized analysis. You can't actually solve the linearized differential equation exactly, but you can play various games and extract various quantities analytically. So for example, you can extract a dispersion relation, non-relativistic dispersion relation for this quark, which has this nice form, m rest plus p squared over 2 times kinetic mass. So one thing I can say about this is that the rest mass and the kinetic mass are not the same. That's kind of interesting, but it's consistent with the fact we're at finite temperatures, so we've broken Lorentz invariance. Another thing you can extract is this friction coefficient in the large mass limit. It typically will scale as 1 over the mass. In the large mass limit, there's really not effectively much difference between the rest mass and the kinetic mass. And the last thing you can extract, which I think is in some sense the most interesting, you can extract mu in the small mass limit. So as you bring the D7 brain closer and closer to the horizon, being careful to keep the TUF coupling large enough so that you still have a semi-classical string, mu seems to be 2 pi times the temperature. Okay, so we did that in the super Yang mills background, which was some black hole in ADS5. So what you could imagine now doing is thinking about a more general metric, which still has a horizon in it, still is asymptotically ADS, So I want to think about classes and metrics which say are, which are dual to, say, marginal deformations of n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, or you know, the 5D effective description of this Yang-Mills raised at finite R-charge chemical potential is in this class, so this, you can also get some results for chemical potential. Or you can, I haven't really specified a dimension here, so you could study similar backgrounds in other dimensions. So if I take this ansatz for my metric, asymptotically ADS and has a horizon, then these three predictions I gave you on the previous transparency, they're all still true. You still get this dispersion relation, you still get this scaling, 1 over M scaling, and you still get this result 2 pi T. Well, maybe this and this is sort of forced by symmetry. Maybe it's not so interesting, or dimensional analysis, but this is kind of neat, this 2 pi T. And in fact, to get that 2 pi T, I need one more assumption. I need to assume that the derivative of the xx component of the metric is positive with respect to the radius at the horizon. So for this metric, the entropy of the black hole, essentially the area of the black hole, or the entropy of the field theory, scales as gxx to some power. So what I'm saying here is I need the entropy to increase if I were to make the black hole a little bit bigger. Well, that's not really true, because making the black hole bigger will change the metric, but it's sort of interesting that I think I need this condition. Another thing you can do, so you couldn't solve this linearized equations exactly, but you can make plots of what mu does numerically, and you see it will fall down from this value 2 pi t. It will fall down and then match onto this large mass result. I've also have a 2D result, which you may or may not be able to see. It's this green line, and I've done a funny scaling here so that I'm not plotting exactly the same things, but in the right units, this also goes to 2 pi t at the for these light mass quarks. So on the horizontal axis here, I plotted ym, essentially 1 over essentially um, which is essentially a proxy for the mass of the quark. So they all go to 2 pi t at light mass, and they're all monotonically decreasing. And in fact, all the plots I made, these masses, these friction coefficients are monotonically decreasing. So it's very tempting to speculate that this value, this value 2 pi t is an upper bound on the friction coefficient, very much in a similar spirit to this viscosity bound. This viscosity to entropy ratio is bounded below by 1 over 4 pi t. So I think if you were looking for some similar story in this heavy quark setup, this bound on the friction coefficient is probably what you would want to look at. There are a number of issues about this friction coefficient bound, which I'll just sketch, which makes it far from well established. So I've assumed to do this analysis that I can use some kind of five-dimensional reduction. So I'm using the 5D Nambu-Goto action. So for example, if you were to look at the full 10D solution and solve the Nambu-Goto action there, often the string solutions look very different. This is a problem that came up, was brought to my attention by a nice paper by Elena Caceres and Alberto Grijoso, where they looked at the finite chemical potential string and got a very different answer from the one I got, because they were doing the 10D problem and I was doing the 5D problem. I would hope so. Yeah, or that there's some straightforward way of mapping these 5D solutions to 10D. That there, if you have a solution in 5D, you can map it back to 10D, some 10D completion in this chemical potential setup, but that I haven't been able to do. Yeah. That's also true. You don't want all those extra adjoint scalars. That's a good point. Another interesting thing is it's possible to find backgrounds where this derivative is negative. So there are regions of this n equals 2 star solution by Bukel and Liu where this guy is negative, perhaps. And this was pointed out in a recent paper by Eduard Antonian from Chicago. So we're still looking at that. And my hope is that, at least in this particular background, or more particularly Jim and Alex are looking at it, and I'm standing on the sidelines. I'm hoping that for those particular solutions, they'll be sick in some other way. We'll see. And the last thing that makes me a little bit nervous about this bound is that I'm really doing a light quark limit of a heavy quark system, so I really have to tune this TWIFT coupling large to keep things classical. But I have an ongoing project with Andreas Karch and Kristen Jensen at Seattle, where we're trying to look at things that are legitimately light quarks rather than light quark limits. Okay, so that
those patterns where that derivative is negative, is the entropy increasing with the temperature of state?
I don't quite know how to answer that without having the equations of motion for the background.
But the background is known, right? So you just need to configure the horizon?
Yes.
And that's what increases, is that an increasing function of the temperature?
For the n equals 2 star solutions,
yeah.
In particular, I don't know.
We should look at that.
Because if it's not, isn't that any study?
I think so, yeah.
Well, I think probably all these backgrounds are, all the n equals 2 star backgrounds are g prime less than 0 or physically. Partially, you know, you do this near the horizon, you can, you know, develop your series expansion a little bit, but you cannot extend that out to the boundary of the idea. I don't think you'd reach it. I think it's
an N equals 2 star was just N equals 4 with a mass from one type of multiple, is that right?
Yeah.
So what's unphysical is people chose as an approximate solution. What's unphysical about it?
Oh, so sort of a longer story here, but there are, maybe it's not quite fair to call this N equals 2 star anymore. There are these, so in the supergravity dual of this, there's this effective 5D supergravity, which depends on these two scalars and the values of the two scalars at the horizon, which allow you to tune this G prime, are related in a very complicated way to the mass of the scalar and the fermion and the hyper. So ideally, you'd want to tune those so that the bare masses at zero temperature were the same. And I think in that case, this is certainly not true. G prime is always greater than zero. But if you want to relax that and look at other values for the masses, then
the issue here is that the direction along the horizon is shrinking as you go out, as opposed to expanding like it normally is.
Right.
Making it turn around somehow and get out to the usual, to match the usual ADS asymptotics may not be possible.
And numerically, I don't think any of these solutions that reach ADS asymptotics.
Oh, so you know what the asymptotics are? It's not ADS.
I don't know what the asymptotics are, but it's very likely there are no asymptotics. There wasn't
a
singular problem with
it. If you're saying you have one parameter and n equals 2 star solutions, can you do in the actual n equals 2 star field theory? Because people have a problem with cutting parameters.
You're also saying these aren't solutions,
it's very likely there are no good solutions. Because this is just a local horizon analysis. It's near the horizon, the metric factor shrinks a little bit. You don't know if that matches up to anything.
So I've come to the end of my talk, and so I just want to leave you with a few thoughts. One is that we have a calculation of a diffusion constant for a strongly coupled theory. So even if you debate whether this is really related to QCD in any quantitative way, it is interesting in its own right. And I also have this interesting universal friction coefficient bound. This one? I think potentially, people have, and a lot of people who work on this also spend some time thinking about, say, Bose-Einstein condensation, and there's some close analog with elliptic flow to the expanding, well, it's not for Bose-Einstein condensation, but I guess for the degenerate gas of fermions, there's some close analog to elliptic flow of the heavy ion collisions and the expanding cloud of degenerate fermions. So there are very few techniques available for computing these time-dependent quantities in the quark-gluon plasma. There's perturbation theory and string theory. Perturbation theory doesn't really appear to be relevant for the regime at RIC, and string theory is valid in the right regime, if you believe lambda equals 20, but describes essentially the wrong theory. And so I leave you with a thought, or a short story rather. It's important to ask the right questions that it took some time to look at this entropy to viscosity ratio. I think the viscosity for N equals 4 super young mills was calculated in something like 2002 in a PRL by Sunstarnitz and Policastro. And the bound was not conjectured for another 2 years. It wasn't another 2 years, but four people really thought to divide eta by s and say, oh, it's always 1 over 4 pi. And I think maybe we're at that stage here with this, too, that some smart person will come up with a better way of organizing this information. So I leave you with that thought. Thanks.
When you calculated the jet quenching parameter, you made this comment about the Algernon relativistically, and that could be reasonable discrepancy. What's non-relativistic, and I guess what do you expect from the data?
So we made this assumption that we could convert a friction coefficient into a jet quenching parameter using some kind of Langevin equation. So that assumes that you have some kind of white noise acting on the quark with some isotropic distribution. So non-relativistically, that isotropic distribution of force makes a fair amount of sense. But as you get to higher speeds, it's not so clear that white noise would still be just white noise. And if that's true, then this is probably false.
So what do you expect for a quark and rip? So like where in some parameter measuring how relativistic you think it is, where does this lie? So
it depends on what quarks and at what time in the collision. And so for example, I guess for bottom quarks, they tend not to be too relativistic. They tend to be moving, what was it? What did I read? Something like two-fifths or half of the speed of light, if I remember right. But apparently they're moving slow enough so that they decay rather rapidly. Whereas charm quarks would be moving faster, and so you have different processes that might potentially be important. These collisions are very complicated, and it's not clear to what extent string theorists can just jump in and say, here's a diffusion constant, now all your problems should go away. But we can try.
Thanks, Chris.